This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You've been waiting, I know, and patiently, too. We appreciate that. Today, in part the third, why nobody went to jail. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Thursday today, the 28th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have come today to part three of the financial crisis narrative that we have been laying out for you on the program this week in search of the answer to this question. Why didn't anybody go to jail for their part in the financial crisis? It's a deceptively simple question with a complicated and honestly sometimes frustrating answer. To get there, we have told you about how earlier crises were handled, the savings and loan scandal and the collapse of Enron. We looked at the time in 2009 that prosecutors tried to put a couple of hedge fund executives in jail, but couldn't. We've done history and we've done context. And today, finally, the politics.
There shall be no place for political favoritism, no reason to be timid in enforcing the laws that protect our rights, our environment, and our principles, as long as I have the opportunity to lead this great department.
Eric Holder was the Attorney General of the United States from 2009 to 2015. That was part of his speech after his swearing-in by Vice President Joe Biden, you just heard there. Holder had been in the Justice Department before, Deputy AG in the Clinton administration in the late 90s. William D. Cohn is a former Wall Street banker turned journalist and author.
Once upon a time, when Eric Holder was not the Attorney General of the United States, but he was in the Justice Department, he authored a memorandum.
The subject line reads, Bringing Criminal Charges Against Corporations. It goes 12 pages with footnotes. Prosecutors, Holder wrote, should take collateral consequences into account when conducting an investigation, determining whether to bring charges, and negotiating plea agreements.
And I think that Eric Holder decided that there were real risks with indicting corporations because jobs can be lost.
That memo and its message became known as the Holder Doctrine.
And then when he became U.S. Attorney General, that was sort of lingering in the background and probably influenced whether or not he made the decision to investigate fully and choose to indict or have his U.S. attorneys indict individuals and corporations for their behavior during the financial crisis.
To be clear, the decision whether to indict a corporation, defer prosecution, or decline altogether is not one that I or anyone in the criminal division takes lightly.
Lenny Brewer was Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice, that is, working for Eric Holder, from 2009 to 2013. This speech is from 2012.
We are frequently on the receiving end of presentations from defense counsel, CEOs, and economists who argue that the collateral consequences of an indictment would be devastating, just devastating for their client. In my conference room over these past years, I've heard sober predictions that a company or a bank might fail if we indict, that innocent employees could lose their jobs, that entire industries could be affected, and that even global markets will feel the effects. Sometimes, though let me stress not always, these presentations are compelling.
Recapping, then, here is where we are. Two Wall Street guys running a couple of Bear Stearns hedge funds acquitted. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, and his Assistant Attorney General running the Criminal Division, Lenny Brewer, keenly aware of the effects indictments could have on big banks and companies. Just a little bit farther down in the Justice Department org chart, though, there was a different perspective.
My name is Paul Pelletier, and I was a federal prosecutor for approximately 25 years, just a little bit more.
We met Paul Pelletier briefly in Part 1, the prosecutor who helped missionize and train prosecutors after Enron. Pelletier was an assistant U.S. attorney in Miami. Then he moved to the Justice Department proper, eventually becoming principal deputy chief in the criminal division's fraud section. He was managing accounting and foreign corruption and healthcare fraud cases for nearly a decade.
People didn't get prosecuted during the financial crisis or high-level executives simply because of a lack of commitment, competence, and courage by the political leaders in the Department of Justice. That's what I observed. That's what I saw. That's what I felt. And that's why I left the Department of Justice, because there was a lack of commitment on the part of the Department of Justice's leadership that I had never seen before.
Remember that story we told you yesterday? What James Comey, when he was the head of the Southern District, called those kinds of prosecutors? The chicken shit club.
In the financial fraud crisis of the late 2000s, where it was the biggest indication to me and prosecutors across the country that the department didn't have either the commitment, the competence, or the courage to bring these cases, was the SEC brought a case against Countrywide's Angelo Mozzillo for securities fraud. And that complaint, if you read it, sets forth some pretty heinous activity by Mozzillo and by Countrywide in the falsity of their representations with respect to their mortgage portfolios. Within 12 months of Mozzillo settling that case with the SEC, the Department of Justice declined criminal prosecution. That's impossible. If you're competent, that's impossible. If, in fact, you have commitment, and that's impossible if you have courage, because if you read the complaint, read criminal all through it, criminal fraud all through it. That was a sin, and that indicated to all the career prosecutors that I knew that the Department of Justice wasn't committed to bring these cases. Look, I was a hockey player growing up, and I learned very early that in order to enforce fair play on the hockey rink, sometimes you just gotta punch the cheater or the bully in the nose, whether you're gonna win the ultimate fight or whether you're gonna lose. But sometimes that's right, and that's just what you have to do to enforce fair play. And that's what people expect of the Department of Justice as well. You're not going to win every case, but you have to show the American public that there's a cop on the beat and that people who have wealth, who have money, who take advantage of the criminal laws and violate those criminal laws need to be prosecuted. That didn't happen in this crisis.
Think back to Enron, where the Justice Department created the Corporate Fraud Task Force, and virtually every top executive at that company was indicted. Also, the savings and loan crisis, almost 5,500 criminal investigations, 1,000 criminal prosecutions, more than 800 convictions.
And so the Corporate Fraud Task Force for the Enron accounting fraud type cases was part of my experience in the Department of Justice and one of the reasons why I joined the Department of Justice to participate in these efforts that actually made a difference in our country.
And so after the crisis, Pelletier watched and he waited while investigations into executives from Countrywide and Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers and AIG, the big insurance company, he waited while those fizzled out and died.
On a personal note, I personally tried to prosecute executives at AIGFP. And each and every step along the way of my investigation, I was discouraged from continuing and furthering the case. Discouraged at every level in the department, to the point where I was told that unless I could guarantee a victory, I wasn't going to be allowed to bring the case. And that's the first time in my more than 25 years in the Department of Justice that I've ever had that conversation with anyone.
Pelletier says the Office of Assistant Attorney General Lenny Brewer wanted a guaranteed conviction in a case against AIGFP executive Joseph Cassano.
And I refused to guarantee a win because I wasn't going to do that because I thought it was an improper question.
Pelletier left the Justice Department in 2011 over those decisions not to prosecute. And we should tell you here as well that Pelletier ran for Congress in 2018 as a Democrat, lost in the primaries. In the spring of 2009, Congress and the White House created the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC it was called. Phil Angelides was the chairman. Do you think any laws were broken in the financial crisis in the run-up to it?
Well, what I do know is that our commission found that there were potential violations of law that we believed needed to be further investigated by the Department of Justice. As a commission, we took our responsibility to make these referrals to justice very seriously. We looked at the documentation that we had uncovered in interviews, in hearings, by subpoena, by requests for documents. When we sent these referrals over to the Department of Justice, we fully expected that they would get a top-to-bottom scrub from the Department of Justice. And it's very clear now, years after the fact, that that never occurred. That at each of the banks, for example, where we identified mortgage security fraud activity, my expectation is that the Department of Justice would have gone in and gone from bottom to top at that institution to find out who was ultimately responsible for the conduct. It never occurred. And in fact, when you look at the settlements that the Department of Justice entered into with these big banks, what's remarkable is not one human being is named. As I said, banks engaged in misconduct, but somehow, miraculously, no banker was involved. It's not right, and I think there will be long-term consequences for the decisions not to pursue these cases. Not as a matter of vengeance, not as a matter of putting heads on a stake, but consistent with American law and justice.
According to Angelides, the commission sent 11 separate referrals of both companies and individuals, along with supporting documents and evidence, to the Justice Department, with the expectation that it would do what it did during the savings and loan mess: investigate the wrongdoing the commission had uncovered and prosecute where appropriate.
It is one of, I think, the very disappointing legacies of the financial crisis. The simple fact is the Department of Justice never mobilized the resources to thoroughly investigate the wrongdoing that occurred in the run-up to the financial crisis. And having failed to investigate, never then applied the resources and the will to prosecute. It remains an enigma to me, but it's one of the seminal failures of the tenure of Attorney General Eric Holder in the Obama administration.
So look, I don't want you to leave this story thinking civil penalties, those fines and settlements, Bank of America's $16.6 billion, Citigroup's $7 billion, the $13 billion from JPMorgan Chase, the $5.1 billion from Goldman, to name just a couple. I don't want you to think that those are somehow outside the norm, because they're not. Pam Pearson has taught law at the University of Alabama for 30 years. She started out as a federal prosecutor.
These civil remedies can truly be a way of changing market behavior for the better of corporations. When you're thinking about, all right, do we pursue this type of white-collar crime criminally, which is going to be chancy and hard to win, or do we use some of these very, very powerful civil options that we've got and go after them civilly? Lots of times it makes sense to go after, especially if you have a big group of white-collar offenses, to go after those offenses civilly instead of criminally. So that by 2008, when you had the collapse of so many financial institutions from what looked like pretty apparent fraud, there was already a very viable precedent within the Department of Justice of handling white-collar cases through these formidable civil remedies instead of criminal prosecution.
The problem, of course, is that people's lives and this economy were changed by the crisis and the recession in ways we are still recovering from. And having a bank's shareholders pay even billions of dollars in civil penalties doesn't seem like justice.
Now, what I think in hindsight is the problem with how the financial fraud cases were handled is that not enough were prosecuted. Even with all the good policy reasons to pursue fraud cases with civil actions and remedies rather than criminal. Even with all those good, viable policy reasons, it sends important messages to prosecute something criminally. It tells the world that no one is above the law, that everyone is subject to the laws of the United States.
We asked everybody we talked about in this story for interviews. President Obama didn't respond to our interview request. Eric Holder declined. Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York after the crisis, declined as well. Lanny Brewer, Holder's person running the criminal division, didn't respond to multiple interview requests. And Angela Mozzillo, the founder and CEO of Countrywide, didn't respond either. So I told you it was frustrating, right? The answer on why nobody went to jail? Some or even a lot of what Wall Street did during the crisis wasn't illegal. And for the parts of what Wall Street did that were illegal, fines and settlements are well within the norm. But here's why the answer, frustrating or not, matters. It matters because the reasons nobody went to jail aren't about crises past. They're not about mortgage fraud or which CEO did what or whatever you think of when you think about 2008. The reason it matters is because of the crisis next time. And there is going to be, by the way, a crisis next time. That's just not me. Everybody says that. If somehow you missed a part of this series, we've got all of it online, as well as a cast of characters and a little bit of financial crisis history reading, should you so choose. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
With a dollar-for-dollar credit, all $5 billion would be coming out of the federal government's budget.
School credit meet tax credit. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 69 points today, 0.2%, ended at 25,916. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ down 21 points, about 0.2%, 75.32. The S&P 500 dipped 7 points, about 0.2%, closed at 27.84. JCPenney surged 22% today. The department store operator said it plans to close more of its stores after a weak holiday sales season, but it issued a better-than-expected fourth-quarter forecast. Sears down 7.9%. Macy's gave back 2% today. Tesla shares gained 1.5% today, and that was ahead of news that the company's going to close most of its retail stores. All sales are going to be online. Those stores that stay open will be showrooms only. But I'll tell you, Tesla shares down a bunch after hours. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It was a bit late, a month late, technically, due to the shutdown, but we got our hands on economic growth figures for the fourth quarter this morning. October through New Year's, gross domestic product grew at a 2.6% annualized rate for the full year, just shy of 3%, which led to Larry Kudlow, as he often does, the president's chief economic advisor, by the way, led to him showing up on CNBC saying this.
The policies we put in place on these lower tax rates and deregulation and, you know, China trade, USMCA. We haven't talked about Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. There's a historic agreement there that's going to be great for business and economic growth and jobs. These policies are working. So I'm going to say 3% 2018, and I'm going to say 3% 2019, and 3% as far as the eye can see. I'm sure we'll revisit that at some point.
Revisiting perhaps sooner rather than later because Mr. Kudlow's predictions are not universally shared, I had the economic growth conversation with former Fed Chair Janet Yellen when we sat down last week.
You know, we had a period of remarkable growth in 2018, or probably around 3%. That just isn't sustainable.
It's so funny that you say 3% is remarkable growth because that for years was the norm.
That was the norm, but we're in a world of both slow labor force growth and low productivity growth, and probably a sustainable pace of growth in the U.S. economy is around 2 or possibly even a little under.
Might not sound like much, but that difference between 2% or a little less and the White House's 3% has some big implications, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
With GDP growth at 2.6%, the economy was still running pretty hot as we closed out 2018. The dawn of 2019 hasn't been quite so rosy, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
Growth is weakening from the sugar high burst it got early last year from the tax cuts.
So the best of recent economic times, we've already had them.
2018 growth was the high watermark for the Trump administration.
Zandi pegs the long-run sustainable growth rate of the economy at around 2%. And why does this matter? Well, to start with, slower growth means less revenue coming in from taxpayers, which could drive up annual deficits. And that's as the deficit has risen sharply, due in part to the 2017 tax cuts, says Mark Goldwine at the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
2% year-over-year growth just isn't going to be enough, certainly to keep our debt under control.
Though he says even if we managed to repeat last year's nearly 3% growth rate, it still wouldn't be enough.
You would need something like 4 or 5% real annual growth to stabilize our debt over the next couple of decades. And that's just not realistic.
Not realistic because of structural changes to the economy, like an aging population with fewer working age adults. Which brings us to another implication of slower GDP growth. Middle-class Americans won't see living standards rise as much. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
President Trump is on his way home from the North Korea talks, deal not in hand. The president said today before he left Hanoi that things fell apart over sanctions. So we thought it might be a good idea to review just what the sanctions situation is. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
There are layers of sanctions on North Korea, and they've been building up for decades. The most comprehensive come from the United Nations, says Jim Schoaf at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
They cover imports of oil, aviation fuel, these manufactured goods. Also, they prohibit the export of coal, seafood.
On top of the UN sanctions are those from individual countries like the U.S.
The U.S. side is mostly doubling down on the financial piece for certain individuals and people that we think have done cyber crimes or other types of things.
And the U.S. has been ramping up pressure in the last few years, broadening the net to include more people and companies working with the North Korean regime. Ashley Fang is with the Center for New American Security.
You saw more pressure and more implementation of these sanctions by countries that may not have been as cooperative as they were before, so specifically China.
Fang says even with the crackdown, North Korea has workarounds.
You had instances in which you had Russian ships out at sea in which they would then conduct illicit ship-to-ship transfers of oil. And there were also some reports of Russia not ending the employment visas of North Korean workers.
But so far, the UN and the U.S. sanctions haven't been enough to make North Korea drop its nuclear program. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The Trump administration is doing some tinkering with the education economy. This morning, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced a $5 billion a year plan to give tax credits to people who donate to scholarship programs for private schools. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress, Ted Cruz of Texas in the Senate, Bradley Byrne of Alabama in the House, have introduced legislation creating such a program in their respective chambers. There are similar tax credit voucher programs in 18 states already. School choice is the umbrella policy vocabulary you're looking for here. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on how it all works.
Growing up poor in Jacksonville, Florida, Denisha Merriweather hopped from one public school to another, failed the third grade twice. Then her godmother learned about a private school scholarship.
I became the first in my family to graduate from high school. I got a bachelor's and a master's in social work. Thank you.
Merriweather was one of a handful of students and parents touting the benefits of school choice at this morning's announcement. Proponents say the tax credit proposal won't take a single penny away from public schools. But Carl Davis at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says it will divert money from something.
With a dollar-for-dollar credit, all $5 billion would be coming out of the federal government's budget, and it means there'll be less revenues available for any other program.
Public schools could lose money that's allocated based on their number of students. Julian Vasquez Heilig, education chair of the California NAACP, says when students leave,
the schools still have to provide the same services to their community that they've promised them, whether it be busing, food service, class sizes.
The bill faces an uphill battle in a divided Congress, but Robert Enloe with the advocacy group EdChoice says it's still worth debating.
I think it's really important to have a conversation started at the federal level, at the national level, about what's best for kids, and that we need to build as much momentum as we can.
And that momentum has been growing as more states enact tax credit scholarships on their own. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is going to involve A, a little bit of math, and B, a hat tip to Darren Revelle of the Action Network. Baseball fans will have heard by now that our long national free agent signing nightmare is over. Bryce Harper signed with the Phillies today, 13 years, $330 million. Revelle did the math. The average major leaguer comes to the plate 550 times in a season. 550 at-bats times 13 seasons of the deal is 7,150 at-bats total. $330 million divided by 7,150 is just over $46,000. Again, that is what Harper is going to make every time he picks up a bat. The median household income in Philadelphia, according to the Census Bureau, $41,000 a year. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials down 69 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 21 points, about 0.2% there. S&P 500 dipped 7 points. How many percent? 0.2%. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. One more time, why nobody went to jail. It's on our website, marketplace.org. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.